So what I'm saying is we got to break these guys apart. You want to run a platform? That's fine. You don't get to run a whole bunch of the businesses as well. You want to run a business? That's fine. You don't get to run the platform. Think of it this way. It's like in baseball. You can be the umpire or you can own one of the teams, but you don't get to be the umpire and own the teams.
And let me just get this clear. If you had your way, Facebook would have to sell off Instagram. Mm-hmm. Amazon would have to sell off Whole Foods.
All those little businesses that they're running, competing businesses. Yep.
Who is the federal government to tell these companies they have to do that?
There's antitrust law. It's been around for more than 100 years. And the federal government has done this many times. For example, broke up Standard Oil, broke up the great monopolies of the late 19th century and early 20th century.
That was Massachusetts Senator and second-tier presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren talking to CBS News about her proposal to break up the big tech companies using language designed to make me understand, apparently, their metaphor. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of The Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, here with my colleagues Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Top of the morning, lads.
Aloha.
Hey, Matt.
Well, it's Monday.
That was my endorsement of Tulsi Gabbard.
Wow. I mean, it's a little bit early in the primary season, Catherine, to be going full Tulsi. Maybe it's time to take a bold stance. Suter Pants, you're the one who is excited about this. Elizabeth Warren, like you, is widely seen as kind of the candidate who has the most specific policy chops in the field, or at least the most willingness to go out there.
I am not a candidate. And anybody who sees me as a candidate,
are you ruling it out? Are you ruling it out?
Yeah.
Just categorically? Fact check, I'm not.
You can take Florida. It's an important swing state. What does her kind of standard oiling of big tech exactly mean, and why don't you love it?
I think, you know, on the one hand, she is portraying this as a really sweeping and ambitious plan to remake big tech in particular, but in a lot of ways more than that, to remake the entire American economy and the way it operates right now, where, you know, a huge amount of the growth and innovation is coming from the tech sector, in particular from these big firms that are that often pay their workers quite well and, you know, sort of really kind of engines of growth and innovation in the economy. And she, in many ways, just sort of wants to set the federal government up as the arbiter of what they can and can't do and what businesses they can't be in. And so on the one hand, there's really kind of a grandiosity to this plan that I think is really telling and really revealing about how Elizabeth Warren sees both the federal government's role and her own. On the other hand, there is something just incredibly small and petty about it, because, you know, the clip that we heard at the beginning here, she's talking about all of these companies having to break up with their with the sort of other businesses they run. So Facebook would have to be split off from Instagram. Amazon would have to be split off from all of its small house brands.
Well, and when she says all those little companies, right, it's like Whole Foods. You
right.
Know,
so Whole Foods is not
Instagram,
a little company.
Like,
and in fact, if it is an Amazon company, or Amazon label, I should say, it kind of by definition isn't a little company.
Yes.
But let's look at one that is really important to my life, Amazon Basics. Amazon Basics was, I believe, Amazon's first house brand, certainly one of the first house brands, started by selling pretty much generic batteries that were great and much cheaper than competitors. And then they expanded that to selling stuff like sheets and towels. And in particular, where they've really made their mark is they sell inexpensive, basically generic brand charging cables and like electronics connectors. So, for example, the Wire Cutter, which is a great consumer reviews site. It's pretty much Consumer Reports for the internet age. It's really wonderful. They make all their money through referral links. So basically, if they convince you to buy stuff, they do well, right? They're not being paid by anyone to review these products. They say that that Amazon Basics HDMI cable is the best HDMI cable. Amazon built this kind of mini business within Amazon, and it solved a real problem, which was that if you, say, own an iPhone and you need a replacement charging cable or a secondary charging cable, you have two options. You can go to Apple, and Apple will charge you $30 or $35 or something ridiculous for a little lightning cable, or you can purchase something cheap and generic that may or may not work, or may or may not work for very long, for a very long time. We've all had that experience of getting the secondary replacement cheapo cable for $4 and it lasts for 2 days, or it doesn't work at all. Amazon Basics sells cheap replacement cables that always work and work quite well. They solved a problem in the market. They made everyone's life, or a lot of people's lives, just a little bit better. Elizabeth Warren wants to stop Amazon from solving problems like that.
In the name of preserving innovation too, which is what this
her whole thing is, that this is that Amazon is squelching competition. But what she is really doing is putting a stop to something that is actually providing a consumer benefit right now. And it's really small and petty. And like what I wrote about last week, and what kind of grates me here, is not just that you'd be losing these cables, most likely. It's possible that the spinoff brand would still exist on its own, but it's not just that you'd be losing those. It's that what Elizabeth Warren really wants is to be the middleman in between you and every single transaction that you make. And it's just awful.
I want her to follow the logic of her argument and start going into supermarkets and saying, you know what, get rid of your house brands. Kroger, you can run the marketplace. You can run the utility platform of where people go to buy food. But you're not putting Kroger brand anything out there because you have a competitive advantage and you're somehow squelching innovation and whatnot. Or, the idea behind this is so fundamentally wrong, and it draws specifically the wrong lesson from the history of antitrust law, which we've written about a lot at Reason over time. It's just being projected into cyberspace now. And because of that, we all lose our shit the minute that we leave the planet and start talking about something online. To say that Amazon somehow is destroying competition, is destroying innovation by giving people more stuff in wider varieties than ever at better prices delivered right to your door. And that, somehow that's squelching innovation. Elizabeth Warren is, one of a broad group of people who are trying to resuscitate antitrust law from a specifically Brandeisian point of view, which Louis Brandeis, the associate justice on the Supreme Court in the 19-teens through the 30s and a little bit beyond, he literally believed that any business that got too big was problematic just because it got so big. And he fetishized and idolized small businesses that his, like the ones his father ran in Louisville, Kentucky around the turn of the century. And he believed that bigness squelched competition and squelched innovation. In fact, when you go back and look at the history of things like Standard Oil, at the moment that it had peak penetration into the domestic home and oil industry and stuff like that, was actually charging the least amount that it ever charged for its products. So the idea that bigness equals bad and destroys competition or causes consumer harm is wrong. And this is the big shift that these people are working for, the new antitrust people, sometimes called hipster antitrust. What they are saying is that for too long, the government has, for antitrust prosecutions, has focused on the idea of consumer harm or the consumer experience, exclusive to other things. And they say, it may even be true that we're getting more stuff for less, we're getting a wider range, higher quality stuff for less money than ever. But that shouldn't be the only predicate when that is confused or ends. That's not the only predicate for government action in these cases. It's very dangerous because it really will go at the, at the center of stuff that has made all of our lives better over the past 20 or 25 years since tech became the sector that it became.
And it's worth going back to the kind of the beginning of big tech with Microsoft, where there was antitrust action. And in fact, one of the kind of there was movement in court to break up Microsoft because the thinking was that Microsoft had created a kind of unfair situation by bundling its browser, Internet Explorer, with the Microsoft operating system. And because the Microsoft operating system was so dominant, it just gave a huge advantage to Explorer and really made it totally impossible for any company to ever produce a successful competitor to Internet Explorer. How many people, it's not, Internet Explorer still exists, but it's not the
actually,
dominant browser.
It doesn't really. It's no longer supported. It's now Internet. They have Edge, but yeah. No, and everybody knew. I mean, kind of, or, you know, who didn't, with, if you had a Windows computer in the late 90s, when browsers, you know, and there were browsers before Internet Explorer, which at when it emerged, it was really a good browser. But then you would get a new computer, you would turn it on, and the first thing you would do is use Internet Explorer once to connect to the internet, and then download the browser that you wanted, and start. You know, it wasn't complicated any more so than Amazon. And, you know, Amazon gives you a portal to a lot of stuff. They are not helping themselves in some way, where Amazon, even as we speak, is now being accused of really squeezing its suppliers, just like Walmart, you know, does all of the time. And while Walmart shouldn't have Sam's Club brands or, you know, George, their men's clothing line, get that out of Walmart, because that's not fair that they're competing against Wrangler, you know, or OP in fucking Walmart's men's section. But what needs to be understood here is that the tech giants are doing everything possible to alienate people at the same time, because Amazon, now over the weekend, they started doing pop-ups where you would be on one company site and they would pop up and say, hey, do you want the Amazon generic? Do you want the Amazon generic? You know, in a way, they're playing with fire here. But we need to have a different understanding of what's at stake here, and also how economies work to produce better outcomes for consumers.
Catherine, you're an Amazon apologist going way back.
I thought you were just going to say, Catherine, you're an Amazon.
I try to act properly in my life.
No, you don't,
Catherine. There was a prominent libertarian person who I saw on television last week. Couldn't leave his name out for the moment. Say, well, you know what? Maybe it's not a bad idea to break up your kind of Googles or your Amazons or your Facebooks, because they're just so big. And when things are so big, that's kind of problematic. They hoover up all of your information. It's bad for privacy. And we're just kind of in this new place right now. That bigness seems kind of difficult to fight against. And, you know, libertarians should be opponents to concentrations of power, period, regardless of whether they're government power or elsewhere. What is your argument against that point of view?
Libertarians should not be opponents of concentration of power. Libertarians should be opponents of concentration of power that's backed by the threat of force. It's a different thing. It's a really, really different thing. And of course, there is fuzzy area where the concentrations of commercial power wind up entangled with the people who back their power by the threats of force. And that should be opposed everywhere and always. Like, the chilling thing, though, is not the fact that there is Amazon Basics. The chilling thing is not the fact that Amazon and Whole Foods are the same company, or that Facebook and WhatsApp and Instacart and Instagram and all the snaps and whatever have become a single thing. It's that Mark Zuckerberg sits in the hearing on Capitol Hill and says, I would love to work with you to regulate this sector. That's the chilling thing. That's the part we should be scared about.
Well, and often it's not just in public.
Right. No, that was right? Nice of him, because that was shockingly transparent. That happened in a room where there were cameras. Normally that conversation doesn't. And, you know, I think the idea of bigness as badness is a really pervasive one. And I think it gets into a kind of lizard brain place. Like, if you generally have a sympathy for the little guy, which almost all humans do, it's a natural human trait to sympathize with underdogs. And you, broadly speaking, see yourself as the little guy, which most people also do, then bigness means other, means bad. But that just isn't actually, that isn't borne out by the results of bigness in this world. The results of big companies in this world, you know, Standard Oil got the name check there. And of course, everyone loves to hearken back to that example. But, you know, even then you can tell a story, and I would and will, about how the alternative is like a bunch of whale fat powering our stuff forever until we die of the lung disease. And that's not good either. Bigness also throws off luxury goods and weird innovations. It throws off Gmail and just so I can go ahead and go for the bingo, rockets.
Finally, rockets. That's all you care about, as long as it ends in rockets.
Do we need a rockets counter?
And it doesn't matter if they're nuclear rockets.
How many minutes since Catherine has mentioned rockets? No, because we'd have to change it.
Matt, one of the things that you're pointing to, though, too, is that this is Warren's rhetoric, or Warren's policy agenda, is particularly dangerous now because she's of the populist left. We have a president of the populist right who is saying many of the same things, and who is his number one go-to attack guy? It's Jeff Bezos and Amazon. And you have in Congress, you have a bunch of idiot Republicans who are so pissed that Diamond and Silk are not bigger on Twitter and Facebook, that they're willing to say, you know what, we have to regulate this. The only reason why Diamond and Silk are not, you know, on everybody's lips all the time is because these companies, these tech companies that have unholy audiences and big, you know, big influence, are squelching the lovely free speech of Diamond and Silk and a bunch of other loser conservative commentators who also, happened to be among the very biggest internet personalities around. So it doesn't make any sense. But what you have now is an unholy, you know, or a coming alliance between populist types on the right and the left who want to regulate companies that they feel are kind of not giving them a fair shake. And, you know, that's really, really dangerous. And I think we need to constantly, you know, both in what Catherine and Peter are talking about, is constantly talking about, you know, there's a difference between becoming big because you are able to, you know, buy more and more government influence to rig the market and to keep competitors out, or to make you give yourself a plum position. And then there is bigness that comes as a result of providing more innovation, more stuff at better and better prices. And it's also true that these companies, the tech sector, you know, the kind of the tech giants, and, you know, there's a range in there, but, you know, they're about 20, 25, 15 years old. They're getting to a point where their markets are starting to mature. We've talked about this in the past. And last year, Facebook daily users, average use in North America, their most profitable place, started to flatten and decline. Twitter, same thing. And lo and behold, these guys start showing up in congressional hearings, say like, yeah, I agree with you. Regulation's a good idea. Of course, you guys know nothing about, I mean, you saw like these kind of mental patients in Congress didn't even know what Facebook was, but they're ready to regulate it. And, you know, Zuckerberg is right to say, you know what, you're going to need a hand there. At one point, he even said, you do realize the rules we put into place will mean there won't be another Facebook. And everybody was like, yeah, I'm okay with that because I don't use it anyway. I don't know, you know, what the hell do I care? I just want to be in charge.
One of the things that I think this really reveals, and Warren's push in particular, but all the stuff that Nick is talking about with, you know, Republicans going after Google and Section 230 and that sort of thing, is that governments, whether or not they know it explicitly, the government views big tech as a competitor and as a threat to their power. And so in a lot of ways, this to me is a power struggle between two of the world's biggest power centers. And one is the American federal government and the other is the American tech sector, both of which end up having a huge amount of influence over the lives of certainly Americans, but also people all over the world. And this is government kind of pushing back and trying to regain some of the power that the tech sector has picked up for itself through market mechanisms.
Well, government views everything as a threat to government.
And but you can see that. Especially very large, very successful corporations.
So you can see that, for instance, this weekend, the president was quite active on the Twitter machine. And one of his thoughts was that he did not enjoy Saturday Night Live, as he often doesn't. And he asks, should
he's
federal
just like us.
Election Commission and or FCC look into this? ? There must be collusion with the Democrats and, of course, Russia. Such one-sided media coverage, most of it fake news. First of all,
that's what the FCC is for.
I like it that he's like, I'm not really sure what the relevant regulatory body is, but I'm sure we have one, because we do, actually, and that's a problem. But this very impulse, this exact impulse of like, thing I don't like is happening. Luckily, we have such an overweening regulatory state. Someone's in charge here. Let's shut it down. You know, it's cartoonish when it comes from the president, and it's, you know, everyone says like, garble, garble, good thought, very smart lady from Elizabeth Warren, but it's the same impulse.
I would like to also point out, though, that it's not always oppositional between big business and big government, because there's a point where they realize they're interdependent. And for instance, you know, the government for its surveillance programs, the Department of Defense isn't coming up with, you know, these surveillance tools or these big data operations, and that's coming out of the private sector. And there's a world of absolute cooperation between all of these companies. And you know, historically, this is something that I think libertarians need to pay more attention to and do more digging on. The tech sector and the Department of Defense during the Cold War, you know, these are very interrelated things. It's very difficult to pull a lot of this stuff out from one another. And it's just, what's great is that there was a surplus of freedom-inducing technology that ended up getting the upper hand, I think, in a lot of aspects in post-war America and made us more free. But what one of the other things that Warren is tapping into, and I think Trump is tapping into, and even people like Ted Cruz, is this fear that companies like Apple, like Amazon, Google in particular, Netflix actually for that reason, have so much information on everything we do and are analyzing it at levels that we can't even really understand, to create a world, you know, that is so curated for us, we don't even realize. Like, it's a little bit of AI here, a little bit of AI here, and they're steering us into this place where we effectively have no autonomy, either as consumers or as thinkers.
So you're starting to sound a little like Elizabeth Warren here, and I'm joking a bit, but her argument is that the reason that Amazon shouldn't be selling Amazon Basics or Stone and Beam or any of its other house brands is that they have, because they also operate the marketplace, they have so much information on what people want to buy, at what prices, how, etc., that it makes it, that it's totally unfair to anybody who wants to compete.
Right, or to shop there too, because you're getting suckered. And this is a return of a particularly strongly worded vision of kind of psychological determinism. You see it, you know, it hit a high water mark in popular culture in the late 50s in Vance Packard's The Hidden Persuaders. But the idea that somehow these companies, these corporations, this technology has the drop on us and we can never get ahead of it. And it's wrong. You know, because it's like, you know, of course, every business wants to believe, no, they know exactly how to predict what you want and then to sell it to you or make you want it when, you know, when you don't really want it, planned obsolescence, all of these types of fears. And we need to be mounting a serious intellectual and ideological opposition to this, because it not only leads to really bad policy, but on a more profound level, it strips us of our basic individuality and our ability to make meaningful decisions in our lives. Sometimes, you know, the people who want to do this, they want to liberate us, but in fact, they're going to end up creating a world in which we have less choice and less ability to decide how the hell we want to live our lives.
I think big tech companies are less good at this than you think. This is one of the problems with this, is sort of the idea that all these big tech companies, because they have information, they do have a lot of information on us, but it's they're not quite as smart about this stuff as a lot of the kind of these sort of super villain corporations ideas, you know, as the folks who are attacking them want us to think. I mean, you know, if you look at the ads that follow you. I bought not too many years ago. I bought a messenger bag, and then for like 6 months, all I had after that were ads for more messenger bags. Right? It was like the idea that because you have already bought one messenger bag, the next thing you want to do is buy yet another $90 messenger bag.
They're just getting started. We're at the dot matrix printer stage of this, and pretty soon, you know, they'll have you perfectly. I agree. I mean, my favorite example of bad ads.
It's just not as smart as you think. At the same time, though, I will also say, if a company has algorithms that can be, that are better at selling me things that I want, I fail to see that, like, how big a problem that is, especially since the alternative was the old, you know, sort of era of TV ads that were completely untargeted, except that they maybe had a demographic profile of people who watched Seinfeld or Star Trek The Next Generation.
Well, this just gets us back to, like, the Bernie Sanders vibe of, like, well, the whole problem is you think you want those things, but you don't.
Is the 34 deodorants?
Flavors
of underarm spray deodorant. He was talking about underarm spray.
Consumerism problem. It's the problem of, like, well, actually, you don't, you know, your truest self doesn't want anything.
I know myself better than Bernie Sanders does.
That's why you're a libertarian, because you think
you're so naive.
Well,
you're so naive.
But do you really know yourself, Peter Sudermann? Because we have spent many episodes of this here podcast talking about your feeling of disquiet, disgruntlement, discombobulations, disfiguration. That's a shout out to our Catholic friends, here about social media, right? So I wonder, and I'm just making this up as I go along, so beware of impending metaphor explosions, but, that, like, it's when you, there is a feeling of societal disquiet, I would say, about social media right now. And it's certainly underlined by the horrific massacre in New Zealand in Christchurch, where some kind of LARPing Nazi white supremacist crossed the line between being a troll and, like, having a bunch of guns and shooting kids. And you see this a lot. And the moment that I'm reminded of with that in terms of policy came from December of 2015, when there was a Islamist attack in San Bernardino. And again, those people had done a lot of Facebook and online activity before. And Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, within hours of one another, said variations of, we need to shut down parts of the internet. So if there is a feeling of societal disquiet over this technological thing that's washing over us, and it feels like we're not really in control of it anymore, isn't it kind of inevitable that this is going to get translated into policy, however ham-handed, to kind of to go at that disquiet? And it makes me even wonder, like, looking back, and Nick probably has the answer to this because his brain is filled with too much information, but, like, whether the trust-busting moment of 100 years ago was based on at least some kind of sense of societal disquiet over the transformations that were associated with the Industrial Revolution, right? It's like, if people feel bad, they're going to, like, want to just strike out and punch something. So, Sudermann, what say you?
I think that there is some truth to that, which is that obviously people do feel unsettled by all of this. I've certainly shared my own feelings of unsettlement, particularly with regards to Facebook. And that when there is a mass feeling along those lines, what politicians are good at is sensing that and capitalizing on it for their own purposes. But what they're not very good at is actually solving the problems that are upsetting people. And in fact, there's a pretty easy way to solve the problem of, I'm spending way too much time on Facebook and it makes me feel bad, which I was. Quit Facebook. It's not that hard. It takes about 60 seconds. And you can even quit in a way that allows you to go back at some point in the future if you want to revive your account, right? There's all these options. I'm not saying they make it super easy, but it's not that hard. And so people really kind of, they outsource their feelings of unsettlement, I think, to political leaders in a way that ends up empowering government, but not actually solving a lot of these problems.
Well, what is the problem that we're trying to solve here, though? Because if people feel uneasy or whatever, you know, they always do. But I think one of the ways to think about, particularly in relation to the way the New Zealand shooter is being talked about, I saw on social media a ton of calls to say, Do not seek out his manifesto. Do not mention his name. Do not do this. You know. Squeeze it down for oxygen to prevent the next massacre. A couple things to say about that is that, you know, social media is relatively new technology. Every new technology that becomes popular because people actually like it or it's useful to our lives, whether we're talking about radio or TV or printing or whatever, it takes a while for society to figure out how to use it in a way that is not fully destructive or disruptive in our lives. You know, this is also true of mass-produced guns, for that matter. And I think what we're seeing is the beginning of a way to deal with some of this stuff. Because, so for instance, happens. It bothers me when journalists of all people are saying, do not seek out and don't read this guy's manifesto, because, you know, this is something that happened that is stunning and horrific. And possibly in his manifesto, you can read that and find out what is going on in his mind that it might be replicated in others. And you want to know that if you want to change society on some level. But, you know, the idea, just to talk about like the ways that customs are changing on social media, a lot of outlets, and actually I do this in my own writing now, like I don't give the name of the serial killer or the mass shooter or something like that. We are not even that slowly, working out a new set of etiquette and a new set of mores that allow us to incorporate social media into our lives where it is not, you know, particularly a negative influence. And that'll vary from person to person. But for God's sake, there's a social learning curve. When cars were invented, it took 10 or 15 or 20 years for people to figure out how to use cars in a way that wasn't, you know, constantly disruptive or distracting. That's all that's going on here with social media. But my point is
just that that's much better worked out. And I don't think you disagree. But my
point
is much better worked out by individuals amongst themselves, sort of trying to figure it out.
Yes, rather absolutely.
Rather than top down by fiat from, you know, elected officials who are saying, well, no, this is how we're all going to do it.
But it's not crazy to say that a side effect of that strategy is the whatever we're calling him, the New Zealand shooter. I mean, Jesse Walker had an excellent post last week calling him the shitpost terrorist. And that's basically what he was. His whole manifesto is just like, insert the man, or, you know, the man internet into a blender.
He calls out PewDiePie. He knows what he's doing. Like, there are motifs and kind of memes in that, you know, that he, right. he you know,
I mean,
that
there's
would
literally
catch
a chunk
more
of the,
attention.
There's a chunk of the manifesto that is just cut and pasted copy pasta from Reddit. There's, you know, he's citing YouTubers. You know, he in some ways is
not just in the manifesto, but while he was
and while he is actually shooting. Executing the horrible act. But as Jesse put it, the fascist terrorist is also a fascist troll. Reading him is like seeing Pepe a Pepe meme carrying an actual gun.
I mean, I think what Jesse's getting at and what we have seen from looking at the manifesto and from the act itself, which was, I believe, not just sort of, there wasn't just video of it uploaded. It was broadcast live. What he has done in some ways is literalize the connection between trolling and violence. And this is, I think, one of the reasons, to go back to Matt's original question, that people are upset with social media, is that social media and places of kind of free-flowing, relatively unregulated conversation, or certainly unregulated by governments, especially where it's anonymous, often have an awful lot of trolling. And so this, to sort of connect to one of our other recurring things, is one of the reasons that people have in some ways soured on free speech, is because they feel like this sort of trolling speech is violent. And frankly, there is a violent aspect to it. I don't mean that speech itself is violence. That is not what I believe at all. But there is a connection to a kind of a violent ideology on the spectrum here with some of the most aggressive and awful purveyors of this stuff.
And yet manifestos are also always just a sample of what happens when you pull the zeitgeist into the mind of someone who was willing to do an act like this in the first place, right? And this is, I mean, the Ted Kaczynski manifesto is this, you know, the
But the Ted Kaczynski manifesto, it captured something about a, you know, it was more than the Unabomber, right? Because that read like Al Gore. And
right,
and, you
that's
know,
what
that's
I
not
mean.
Like a cheap
that's,
joke.
It's a zeitgeist. And the same there's thing a zeitgeist with, thing in yeah. the same way that, you know, mental patients during a certain era all thought they were Napoleon. It's not right. because of Napoleon. It's because...
So
that's
to look at this guy's, it's worth, you know, and it's the same thing with, you know, with Bin Laden's comments after 9/11 or this shooter. He is, you know, at the core, like when you strip away all of the kind of rhetoric of it, you know, he is a, you know, seems to be a very clear case of an alt-right, you know, alt-right person who is disgusted by modernity and by the move of the world from what he perceived as a place of, you know, pure whiteness into something that is much more troubling. And it's degraded, and it's getting, you know, people are getting more coffee colored. And that is at the heart. Where does that come from? And what does it, you know, and none of this is to like kind of appease this or placate it, but it's to better understand it so that we can be talking about stuff in a way that people who are feeling displaced and who are not pieces of shit, like, how do we make them feel more comfortable about the world? Because, you know, the other thing is, like, mass shootings are not increasing, at least according to, you know, in the United States, they're not increasing. Our perceptions of them are increasing. And we need to constantly be toggling back between actual reality and kind of a rhetorical reality so that we don't make policies that end up affecting actual reality based on rhetorical things or fears, media panics and stuff like that. But what is it about, you know, the current world? And we are going through an economic transformation, a global economic transformation, where power is shifting from the West and the North across the world. And it's a good thing, but it is making some people in the West feel like they no longer matter. And people who no longer matter are more likely to do terrible things either to themselves or people around them. And I think that's the conversation that is worth having when we try to understand populism, as well as, you know, specifically right-wing racist fantasies about, you know, stopping the, you know, the brownification of good places, you know, white places like Australia, New Zealand, and parts of America. Or on the left, where it's like these corporations, it's straight out of, you know, RoboCop or something, where they're controlling everything. And we're going to be replaced by robots. We're not even going to be replaced by robots. We're going to be slaves to robots, you know, to AI robots and stuff like that. You know, it's worth thinking these things through and kind of confronting them explicitly and with big numbers.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
I'm going to double segue us here. There's a piece in Politico yesterday with the title "Why Liberals and Big Tech Companies Broke Up," which is a pretty interesting read. And one of the lines in there talking about the 2020 presidential Democratic field and their enthusiasm for Elizabeth Warren style big tech breakups. It says one exception so far is former Texas Congressman Beto O'Rourke, who has largely stayed on the sidelines as tech criticism has grown more fiery and pointed. And I said double segue because we were talking about online culture and stuff like that. And over the weekend, it was exclusively revealed that Beto O'Rourke was a member of something that people claim is an important hacker group called the Cult of the Dead Cow, where he posted as psychedelic warlord, saying all kinds of stupid 16-year-old person nonsense. But I throw this out there. He's the newest entrance into the race, long expected. This morning, we're doing this on Monday, it was revealed that he raised $6.1 million in his first 24 hours of fundraising, which beats even Bernie Sanders. And he's this interesting character in which it's kind of all about the mushy kind of emotional uplift and the way that he makes us all feel and sort of he's trying to stiff arm anyone who's going to pin him down on his actual beliefs, which in terms of economic regulation and debt and deficit are a hell of a lot more centrist than the field out there. So I'll put this to Catherine. When you see Beto O'Rourke out there jabbing with his hands, talking about his deep thoughts about life, does it decisively make you not want to be a member
of
Jazz?
That question had a lot of twists and turns. No, obviously I feel for the hand jabby among us as someone who is afflicted similarly. I that makes me like him more. But yeah, you know, it actually has the opposite effect. It makes me feel like, okay, I thought Gen X was awful. I thought millennials were awful. I thought boomers were awful. But if our assortment at this point is basically, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Beto O'Rourke, or whoever stands in for the millennials now in the actual presidential field, which I don't know, is just the vague socialism of that end of the spectrum, I guess. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, but I was trying to avoid mentioning her because she's mentioned too much. I kind of like Beto the best. I kind of am not hating on Beto. I mean, we have written
Cory Booker.
Some nice Cory Booker, I think is, if we're making categories, he's in the Beto category, right? Except for Cory Booker is going to totally renounce all of his experiments with things that I liked. He is doing it right now with charter schools and a bunch of other stuff, public-private partnerships. Beto, we don't know yet. We have also said some nice things about his record. Matt Welsh has said some nice things about his record in the past. And I don't mind having a centrist guy who made a bad joke about how he's not raising his children and waves his hands too much and has like a weird, you know, hacker background. Like that
former
sounds okay.
Punk rock bassist for president, right?
Yeah, like that sounds like people I know at least, which is, you know, the equivalent of I want to have a beer with him and I don't want to have a beer with him. That sounds really unfun. But yeah, I'm he makes me more Gen X, Matt, in answer to your question.
That's interesting.
I'm not sure what Matt's question was, but great.
Matt's question was Beto question mark. Also, your generation's question
Beto,
mark.
Beto is the emptiest suit to have run for president, you know, since Barack Obama. I mean, he is.
Don't you want an empty suit though, Nick? Like, aren't you ready for an empty suit?
No, I'm ready. I'm ready for somebody who will say, and obviously, besides John McAfee, and I don't want to have a beer with John McAfee. I want to snort black tar heroin with John McAfee. But
is that what you do with?
Yes,
black
you
tar
can.
Heroin?
Trust me.
Okay.
Okay, as long as you're not having his cocktails.
Yeah. So.
So bad.
But so no, terrifying. What I want is a president who says that, you know, we need to redefine, we need to have a conversation about how we redefine America and how we cast it as a framework or an operating system for as many people as possible to peacefully pursue their dreams, to pursue happiness.
I can't vote for you.
But when he talks vaguely about everything and everybody knows that he is hiding the ball because he doesn't know what he wants and he doesn't have a vision for America. And the minute that he gets closer and closer to grabbing that greasy ring and, you know, and stepping on the balding, dandruff flaked heads of Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden to get there, he's going to be the worst of all possible worlds, where he's just going to be a big government liberal. And he's going to get mushier and mushier. And it's just it's not even an interesting fantasy to entertain at this point, as far as I'm concerned. And I think
I
want to
congratulate you on Greasy
I think
Ring.
It is incumbent upon
Greasy Ring
us
is good.
To demand, those of us who will never vote for a major party candidate, to demand better people earlier in the process. Like he's not going to get better. You know, this is the best he will ever be. And it's just not good enough. I mean, and by the way, follow him on Instagram. It's like the only thing he's not doing is showing himself like copping a squat. It's like all he does is post on Instagram now. Like it is very disturbing, to be quite honest.
I would say that he an issue that all of us and the institution that we work for care about, immigration. He's as knowledgeable as anybody in the field.
I agree. And he's got a legislative record that is not as disgusting as any of the Republicans will have. But he also does not, you know, what is his vision of immigration other than Trump wants a wall? I'm going to build down the walls we have. I like that as a sentiment. What does that mean? And is he in favor of letting as many people who want to come in here as long as they're, you know, not criminals, not disease carriers, and they want to work and they forsake, you know, they already can't get, you know, welfare legally. But like, I want to hear him talk about that other, like, I've never heard him talk about why he wants that or what that means. It's like, you know, I'm just saying, don't get excited about him.
I'm just looking at a photo of Beto O'Rourke on Instagram, flipping through a record bin, actual records, vinyl records, saying that he's proud to see the Cedar Rapids community supporting hardworking small businesses like Analog Vault and Edu Skate Board Shop. Thanks for showing us around.
And I'm like
nothing but respect for your president.
Yeah.
So here's my thing, though, Nick. I appreciate what you're saying. I really, really do. I 100% feel your vibe. At the same time, I think
you know, we should also talk about what's possible. And I think that we have recently experimented with the maybe temperament isn't the most important thing. And we have discovered that temperament matters a lot in a president. And the so far on display temperament of the Gen X candidates, of Beto and Cory Booker, looks better to me. It looks like it at least produces results with lower variance. And as long as I have no guarantee that the variance is going to be in my direction, and right now I think it's much more likely the variance will be in the wrong direction based on the Democratic field, I think it's a reasonable stance to say maybe low variance is a thing we should privilege more in this cycle. Maybe someone who's basically going to color in the lines.
Gen X was the clever slacker generation. I spent the weekend listening to the new Stephen Malcolmus solo album, which is like his experimental 1980s underground Berlin dance scene album, except really it's just him playing with a drum machine. This is the guy who was the front man for Pavement, which, like, if you want to sort of, he was Nirvana. He was like the actual Nirvana, right? Nirvana, who was great, but Nirvana was always huge. Nirvana was the Beatles. Like, Pavement was the sort of ideal of the small,
artisanal,
like, actual underground sort of
artisanal
weirdo band,
rock,
right? Yeah. Yes. And, like, and his music was always basically just like, well, stuff's the way it is, kind of not great. I guess I don't care that much. Gonna keep making some weird songs. Then when he had a more popular record, he followed it up with like a record full of songs that were designed to repel his fans because he thought it was funny. And I don't know, like that generational attitude seems basically like what I want in a president.
I just want to point out there's no vowel in between the K
Malcolmus?
And the M.
Did I say Malcolmus?
There, so you said Malcolmus.
I just want to point out I'm also better and more culturally informed than the rest of you, and I have thoughts on it also. The end. Like, really, you're correcting each other's pronunciation?
Wow. Pronunciation
fucking,
was a phase, and we're done with correct spellings and punctuation. They matter no longer.
As a point of answering Nick's question, not to make a broader point out of it, about O'Rourke and border policy and immigration policy. He wants more immigration. He wants actually a guest worker program, which most Democrats have rejected. He doesn't think that necessarily everybody needs path to citizenship. And he's been making the point for more than 10 years that the border patrol and border security there's a diminishing returns problem going on, and also associated with it, lack of accountability and oversight because they're just over hiring down there, and it's created governance problems and actually human rights abuses among the Border Patrol, which all of which are like interesting things that not a lot of people are saying, regardless of other aspects of skateboard Jesus. This is a part of his policy since Suderman started with the Malcolmist concept. Let's talk about
what
we are consuming.
That was not what I was consuming, by the way.
You did just say you listened to it over the weekend.
But, you know, we got to all get ready for...
I know. I understand. I'm just saying.
But he has
I just wanted to make sure that we understood that in the 2020 feel, the 2020
we're the
feel,
Zager and Evans
whatever
happened.
Year we're in.
Peter is
Beto,
way in the future.
Beto O'Rourke is the Pavement of the 2020 field, and I think that's I'm okay with that.
Nick, save us with some actual rock and roll here.
Oh, okay. Well, so what I'm listening to, because Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar, died over the weekend at age 81 or 82. And what I've always been a big surf rock fan, partly because I associate it with the West Coast and reason and libertarianism in L.A. But what I love about Dick Dale, besides the music, which is just frenetic and wonderful and exciting and happy and drama and dramatic and comic at the same time. He started life as Richard Anthony Mansour in Boston, Massachusetts, fell in love with Hank Williams, was dubbed Dick Dale by a guy from Texas, and then, you know, ended up on the West Coast. He's Lebanese-American and Polish and Belarusian, and he became Dick Dale, king of the surf guitar. And surf music kind of, it ended up providing, if the Ramones on the East Coast in punk were a girl group, like a nostalgia act for girl group music, which I think is a fair and proper just, you know, reading of them, all of the West Coast punk bands of note were basically surf rock nostalgia bands. And Dick Dale is just great. And when you listen to his music, I think most people get happy. And I would say go to Spotify and just hit him on artist and listen for a while. And then for those who get really excited by it, he did a cover later in his life of Jimi Hendrix's Third Stone from the Sun, which is this great meta narrative, because in that Third Stone from the Sun from the Are You Experienced album has this, it's a dialogue between two aliens who come to the planet, and they decide that chickens are the smartest beings on Earth, and then they destroy Earth. And Hendrix at one point says the line, "You'll never hear surf music again." And Dick Dale had a particularly interesting relationship to that line. But so
I blacked out for a minute during that explanation and came back to like the chickens taking over the earth. Yeah. I don't know. Oh
yeah, no, that they're the smartest.
That's what happens,
and that's
miss,
why the aliens
like episode 5 of
blow
the
up
HBO
earth.
Show.
Yeah. I still thought it was the white mice or the dolphins or something that were running things.
Dick Dale was so awesome. He played absolutely every instrument in his band better than everyone who played those instruments. So he was a virtuoso trumpet player and there's a drummer and all these kinds of things. Amazing. He also, and this will be my contribution to What Are We Consuming, because of the way that he played guitar. Which it sounds like a percussion instrument. That's because he had like the heaviest strings of anybody. Like think of if you're blanking on who Dick Dale is, mm-hmm. Pulp Fiction, that song,
Miserloo.
That's Dick Dale. That's Miserloo.
Song in the opening section.
Because of the way he played guitar, he partnered with Leo Fender, developer of the electric guitar, and really helped create the Fender brand. Leo Fender was in competition with Les Paul, who we named as one of the 35 recent heroes of freedom in our 2003 anniversary issue. But they are the subject of a book. Great book by Ian Port called The Birth of Loud, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the Guitar Pioneering Rivalry That Shaped Rock and Roll, which is really great. Dick Dale plays a very strong supporting cast role in you know, kind of creating the Fender amps, the Stratocaster, Telecaster, and all these kind of great guitar sounds that came out of that. Total pioneer. And, you know, we think of surf music as the Beach Boys, which is correct on one sense. But even before that, it was all about this instrumental sound that was Dick Dale and the Ventures in particular. And Nick's right. They launched a trillion garage bands and DIY kind of scene throughout Southern California. And that history is with us as we go forward. Catherine, wake up. What have you been consuming?
I am consuming, have been consuming for the better part of a year now, the Harry Potter series. In particular, we are reading Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince aloud, my 8-year-old and I, which is a way of segueing into this weekend's most important cultural development, which is J.K. Rowling just casually revealing that Albus Dumbledore and Gellert Grindelwald had a, quote, incredibly intense relationship. It was passionate. It was a love relationship. And it's just like a whole, like, there was a sexual dimension to this relationship.
Oh.
She's just like going all in. It's like, no one asked you. Here you are, just popping up again to be like, hi, I'm J.K. Rowling, and all of my fiction was super woke and representative, only none of it was in the book. Sorry.
Is it fanfic when it's written by the author?
This is a deep question, actually, which Jesse Walker has explored in our pages. Speaking of Jesse Walker, is it fanfic when you're basically embroidering on your own canon? Is a good question indeed. I'm just enjoying the internet losing its mind about it, including, I think we sometimes say the word meme as if like memes are bad or, you know, memes always cause terrorism or something, but also there's a great meme
only sometimes
that's out there right now that you just put nobody colon and then a blank space and then someone who was inserting something no one wanted to hear into a conversation. So this weekend was 100% nobody colon blank JK Rowling, you know, Dobby headed 10-inch dick. Like that's
Dang!
That's was the best tweet of this weekend, and I wanted to share it with you. And also just keep in mind that while all of this is happening, like in my Twitter, I'm just trying to sincerely read these books to my 8-year-old who just has like purity and love in her heart for these.
The Half-Blood Prince is about the best of the novels, I think, too. It's really good.
Yeah. It's good. I gotta say, it's like it's getting real dark fast though. And I'm here for it, but it's getting a little
it's
tricky.
The Teen Revolt one is my favorite.
The Order of the Phoenix. Yeah. Well, that one's, we were actually talking about this in the office a while back. Like that book is 100% just an allegory for gun control. And I will fight you if you disagree with me.
Wow. I thought it was a preview of the 2016 election and the Trumpian takeover of the GOP.
No, think about it. It's like the corrupt government officials who are trying to disarm the students, tell them they can't learn certain spells, so they meet in secret to 3D print their weapons. It's I'm telling you.
I'm with you
hey,
on
you
that
should,
one.
You sound like a Reason magazine editor.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Peter, do you want to stay on brand here as well?
Yeah, I spent the weekend playing a video game. Tom Clancy's The Division 2. So the technical details are that it's a loot shooter in the vein of games like Anthem and Destiny, also sort of like Diablo, in that there's all these kind of random drops, right? So there's in some ways that you can think of it like a video game version of a slot machine, which is that you're constantly playing.
That's my nightmare.
Which is that you're playing in order. As you take out bad guys, they drop slightly better stuff throughout the game. I mean, and it's an online game, so you're sort of playing socially. There's other people in the world. But what's really interesting about this game is that it's set in Washington, D.C. after a biological terror attack has sort of rendered the city a kind of war-torn wasteland. And it recreates Washington, D.C. downtown. Down to the block, with every single building facade replicated almost perfectly, the exception being some of the signage, some of the very particular things, you know, sort of in individual and specific windows. And it is eerie. It's just strange to be in a near perfect digital replica of the city that that I live in, that I walk around in. Last night, the last mission that I played took me through. It was an hour long raid on what was basically a kind of alt-right militia controlled version of the Newseum, in which I fought my way into the museum, wow. And then up through all of the staircases up to the top, where in the video game version the inside looks a little less realistic, but even still it's like it looks like the museum could look right, like it's just close enough that you sort of feel like, wow, that probably is what the museum is like, unless you've been there enough that you know it's not exactly like that. And at the end, you end up in a TV studio and you have to take control of their broadcast operations.
Which
you know,
exists
to help.
In the museum.
Right. No, I mean, it's not, I like I said, the interior is somewhat less accurate, but even still, it's like quite... it draws a lot from the real museum, and it's just it's actually kind of weird, and it is by far the most realistic depiction of a specific real life place that I've ever seen in a video game, and even if you don't care about the game mechanics and all the other stuff, which I will be writing about in various forums in the future, as a digital replica of a real place, it's incredibly impressive and also kind of strange.
I think you just talked me into having Elizabeth Warren regulate video games. So congratulations, Peter. That's all the time, the regulation and game mechanics that we have time for. Thank you for listening to the Reason Podcast Editors Roundtable edition. Please leave comments wherever you're reading this or listening to it. I should probably stop talking because it doesn't make any sense. And we will see you next week. Thanks.